I did not know this was going to turn into a love story.
That's how it starts. You asked me how I got into marketing.
No, I love it.
Yeah.
So today on the podcast, I have Roger Figueredo. He is the Vice President of Marketing at Hashtag Paid, also the host of DTC Growth Show. So I wanted to bring you on because the last panel that I got to run in February before, you know, the shit hit the fan, you were on it and you had brought up that you actually never graduated, but you did mention that you'd done a bunch of free courses. And with many of us having a lot of free time at home or unfortunately being unemployed, I thought it'd be a good chance to bring you on to kind of discuss what courses that you did take to learn your skill set. So welcome to the podcast. And yeah, I guess, first of all, let's start with your career journey. How did you end up as the vice president of Hashtag Paid?
Yeah. Do you want to go right from the beginning?
Why not?
Why not? Well, I was one of the reasons why I think I didn't prioritize finishing my degree. The primary reason was that I wanted to get married, and my wife lived in Toronto, and at the time I lived in Montreal. And so I knew that if I didn't marry my wife, I'd regret it for the rest of my life. I knew that I loved her, and I knew that I wanted to be her husband. And so I dropped everything else. I knew I'd figure everything else out. Two, I'd say that I was predisposed to a decision like that because I've always been interested in many things. When I was younger, I'd have some people caution me with the phrase, you know, be careful, because if you don't focus, you're going to be a jack of all trades. And so that was kind of my adolescence and my early adult life, was just being interested in a lot of things. And here's an example. I was in a band and I was the songwriter. I was at the same time studying audio engineering. And at the same time, I was studying part-time at McGill, I was studying commerce. And so I've just been fascinated by different disciplines and about learning and growth. And so it didn't scare me to not finish my education. It didn't scare me to move to Toronto to marry my wife, because I knew I'd learn somehow, find a way to grow and to educate myself. And so I wasn't very fearful of that.
Mm-hmm. I did not know this was going to turn into a love story.
That's how it starts. You asked me how I got into marketing.
I love it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you this. When I was with the band, so we were signed, we had a record deal, we traveled, we did some fun stuff. But my favorite part, and I'd say this is maybe where my love of marketing, I think where I consciously acknowledged my love of marketing, my favorite thing about that was actually setting up the tour. I actually had to do it on my own. And our record label wouldn't release our record unless we had our tour set up. And so I hustled to get that ready. I made cold calls. I did outbound work to venues and to promoters. And I was able to do that work. And I enjoyed that a lot. Enjoy all the creative and the messaging around the band. And so all of that stuff together, I think I developed a love for this field. That's how I got started, I'd say.
And what was your first marketing role?
Yeah, so when I moved to Toronto, I got a gig at Achievers on their, they called it member experience. It's essentially like a customer service team. And I, again, like I've said, I'm interested in a lot of different things. And around that time, just before I got married, I got into video. And so I was actually charging for work. I was doing business-to-business videography. And at that time, I also got into wedding videography and wedding photography. So that was the skill set I was picking up around that time. I got my Canon 5D, and I was kind of going all out. And somebody on the marketing team, one of the digital marketing men, he saw a video I made with my iPhone at the company. He said, I want you on my team. And he did everything he could to get me on his team. His name is Tuan. And again, like, I credit where I am today to him, because I don't know what he saw in me. I was really immature. I was unfocused. I was, for lack of a better word, I think it was a bit silly. And he saw the potential in me, and he wrote me into his team. And during their big rebrand from I Love Rewards to Achievers, I was the guy who did all of their video content for that big rebrand. I think we did something like 80 or 90 videos, which was incredible. And so I was the resident videographer, and that's also how I got into analytics. He pushed me and challenged me to get outside of just creating video and to look at the data and to see how I was impacting revenue. And so, and it wasn't of my own volition. I didn't know that's what I wanted to do. There was somebody who saw through, I think, my immaturity, through my lack of experience, through my lack of education. He saw potential in me, and here I am today. So I credit him with getting me my first role.
And were you kind of just learning on the job, or did you take any like online courses at that point?
So I think I, what did I do? I think it was a lot of YouTube, a lot of Googling. It's the wealth of knowledge on YouTube is absolutely incredible. So I cut some pretty good videos at the time. I made quite a bit of money making videos just with stuff that I picked up on YouTube and online. When you had I would try to do something, and if I didn't know how to do it, then I would Google it and watch a YouTube video of it, and that would become forever ingrained in my mind. And so that's how I picked it up. I know what look I want to get, and so I Googled, how do I get this look? Whether it was shallow depth of field, or whether it was, you know, low contrast, or whatever it was, I Googled it, and I saw how people shot, and I looked at their gear, and I looked at their settings, and I looked at their, you know, and then I would just copy it and mimic it. And so over time, that just, your knowledge just builds. And so that's how I got into wedding photography and wedding videography.
Do you continue to edit videos?
Occasionally, I don't have enough time for it. I'll take a couple, if you follow me on Instagram, I take a couple of photos of my family now and then. I still got my gear, so it's kind of worked out during quarantine right now. I'm involved in a charity project or a nonprofit, and we get together every single week, and so we've been able to live broadcast our services every week, and we use a lot of the gear that I've kind of amassed over the years.
I definitely went through a phase probably 5 years ago of like learning how to do video, and every once in a while I go back into it. It's daunting to begin with, but once you kind of get back into editing, it's surprising how quick you remember it all.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm reading a book called Range by David Epstein, and in a chapter I just finished, I think he's talking about how people actually, they remember more if over a certain period of time they don't engage in whatever activity it is they're trying to remember. So if you like, you know, see a bunch of numbers in a row or something, and then you try to repeat them in 5 minutes, you may not remember them, but if you try to repeat them in like 30 minutes or an hour, or even tomorrow, you're going to remember them. It's absolutely fascinating. I don't know exactly why that works or how it is, but it's true. And I feel that way about video. When you get back into it, it all just suddenly comes back.
That is interesting. Yeah. So that's how you learn video. What about analytics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's maybe where I took some courses at the time. And one of them was, so it was the Google Analytics certification. The one, I think at the time it was like $50 or something. So I took that one. I studied it pretty hard.
I think the Google Analytics one is free. It's the Google Ads one that you have to pay for.
Yeah. Okay. So I did both of those. I did all of the Google ones. I did the Facebook ones. And I did one called Market Motive at the time. And they just offered a bunch of courses and all things digital. And so I think I took like, I don't know, four or five or six courses. My employer was kind enough to cover a lot of those courses for me at the time. So it was Market Motive. But a lot of other stuff was online. Just, you have a problem, you got to do something, run into a problem. The process of figuring it out, that's where the learning happens, versus just a course, which is wonderful and great. But solving the problem develops your brain a lot more.
That's one area.
I'm going to go back to YouTube. I'm going to go back to YouTube and Google searches, like the primary vehicles for learning.
Yeah. No, I 100%. I use YouTube a lot. And I do struggle with that. Like, I've tried to do the Google Analytics certification so many times that I find it so dry, because I've done the basics so many times that I never, like, but I learned it over time. You know, you just kind of go in there and play around and figure it out as you go, and lots of YouTube.
You've got lots of YouTube. And I was designing as well. So I was doing graphic design, and I took the Lynda course for Adobe Illustrator. So I did the Lynda's Adobe Photoshop course, mm-hmm. Lynda's InDesign course, Lynda's Premiere course, and Lynda's Illustrator course. I did all of them. So I got pretty adept at the creative suite.
So kind of going back to your first comment, being a jack of all trades, sounds like you've become that. Do you think that's been beneficial to you, or been a kind of hindrance when it comes to marketing yourself?
It hasn't been a hindrance. It hasn't been a hindrance, no. And one of the benefits I've seen is that I can jump into a role and I'm adept and I can solve different types of problems. I'm not specialized in one particular area. And so, you know, for doing this, you know, I can also think of, you know, that and how that's going to tie into this. So for building, you know, a video, I don't just have expertise in how to actually shoot the video and make it aesthetically pleasing. I know how the overlays are going to look and I have a vision for how the typography is going to move, you know, how the bumpers are going to look. And I have an idea of, you know, what I'm going to do after that video. I know that I'm going to transcribe it. I know that I'm going to turn it into a piece of content. It's going to go on the blog. I know how it impacts our SEO. Having done a bunch of different things, you can think that not just the video itself, for example, this is a very micro example. So not just the video, but how it's going to play out in terms of, you know, the overall approach to generating business for the company, for example.
It's definitely something I feel I've struggled with, and a lot of people I know, because I generally come from smaller teams where you do everything. But it's hard to get yourself on a bigger marketing team because everyone's a specialist and you're not quite there to jump to a manager. But that is a comment I've heard from a few people. We did run a careers panel last year, and especially now, a comment that was brought up that people are kind of moving away from agencies more. The manager does need to know how to do everything. So when, you know, the email marketer is off sick, they can jump in and edit, you know, the copy and send it off if they need to. So it definitely seems beneficial, but it's just making that jump. I think I know I would struggle with, and I feel like a lot of people would.
And it comes with learning. The part of being a generalist isn't just, it comes with time, as that, and I mentioned this earlier from David Epstein's book, but you'll read something and then you'll forget about it and you'll come back to it and you'll just, for some reason, pick it up and remember it. And that's the beauty in learning and being a continuous learner. If you're just learning things when you need to learn them, then it's going to take a little bit longer for you to maybe take over that manager role. But if you're just a consistent learner, like if you commit to an hour or two of reading a day, if you can commit to X number of books, if you can commit to X number of podcasts, if you can commit to, you know, solving a problem, launching a side hustle. I've had so many side hustles in addition to my main job that you just pick up things faster than other people. And so because I can speak of how that SEO program is going to impact a bunch of different things, people see value in that versus just that particular role. And so if you're going to go the route of being a generalist, you're going to have to commit to learning and, you know, high intensity learning. You need to learn like athletes train, and you need to be diligent. You need to be intentional about it. It's not enough to, you know, oh yeah, I'd like to pick this up over the next 6 or 7 months. Like, why not do that today? Right? Why not do that this week? Why not start something? Like I would charge for things without actually knowing how to do it. I'd be like, well, I'm going to charge for this and now I got to figure out how to do it. And I did, right? Like I remember I got into website building and, you know, my down payment on my house, a lot of it was paid for by website projects. And I had no idea how to build a website. And I charged my first customer and it was a pretty good website. You commit to projects, learn things, get side hustles, and then you're forced to learn at a very, very fast rate. I think the point there is put yourself in a position where you're being extremely diligent and intentional about your learning.
Yeah, and that actually just came up in the last podcast with Emily Bailey. Like, she said she knew 70% of the project, she'll learn the rest on the job, right? True.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and it's okay. Like, for anyone listening to this, sometimes I thought to myself, like, they're going to find out that I have no idea what I'm doing. And most of the people that I've spoken to share that same sentiment. I think most people have no idea what they're doing. Even very confident people have little idea of what they're doing. What they trust, though, confidence comes from the security and knowing that I've figured it out. Like, when I commit to something, sometimes I have no idea how to do it, but I know that I will do whatever I have to do in order to learn how to do it. And so if you're listening to this and you're like, if somehow you feel inferior to maybe other people or you doubt yourself, just you got to trust that you'll be able to figure it out.
What would you say is your most beneficial skills day to day compared to what is your most marketable?
Interesting. I think for me, because of the season that we find ourselves in marketing, it's the same. We've lived so long in a world where brand dominated the marketing leadership roles that with analytics, demand gen has kind of been a focus now for founders and for leaders looking for marketing leaders. And so I think one of the most desirable skill sets right now in marketing would be the analytical side or the demand gen side or the lead gen side. And that happens to be something that I understand quite well. So I would say for me, the areas where I'm strong in, so the data side, is probably also what's in demand.
And if, let's say someone's mid-career in marketing, like a coordinator specialist level, and they wanted to pivot to demand gen, do you recommend any particular courses they should take or any skills that they should educate themselves in?
Spreadsheet work is inevitable, I think, if you're going to be a good demand gen person. So I think there'd be two. It would be spreadsheet work, and it'd probably be two, it's CRM work. So being able, because that's where the revenue data lives. And so, and if you're going to show up, you know, to a leadership meeting or to a sales meeting or, you know, to any meeting really, you want to be able to pull data from the CRM directly. You want to be able to pull the real dollars. So those two things I probably focus on. Those are important. And the more you understand your CRM, so you know, Salesforce being one of the more popular ones, or HubSpot, if you're in that, understanding the CRM, you can then go back to your marketing automation tool and start building with the CRM in mind. So you can already build fields knowing, hey, I know that I want to pull this data out of the CRM. I know that I need this object to live on, or this field to live on the opportunity object. And so you know that you're going to build it. You know you're going to build it into the marketing automation. You know you're going to put it on a form, or you know you're going to put it on your chatbot, or you know you're going to data append it afterwards. So thinking, you know, if you have the spreadsheet skills and if you have the CRM skills, then you know your automation instance is going to be serving your CRM, and it's going to help you pull those that revenue data.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know you can get now Salesforce certifications too, so that's probably a good route to take as well.
Yeah, it's like it's really cheap. It's really cheap.
Yeah.
A nice hack for getting employed, I think, is just get all the certifications possible. Like you show up with a Pardot certification, whether you understand it or not, it's pretty easy to get through those exams without actually understanding marketing automation. You show up with a bunch of certifications and you'll get a job. I probably shouldn't tell people that, but so when I hire, I don't really look for those things. They don't mean much, but I know to a lot of people they do. So.
So what do you look for?
I said this on an interview a while ago. There's three things. I break it down, and it's fit, fire, fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And I'll go over them real quick. Fit is this person somebody who is going to live the values of the company? So, you know, for example, a hashtag paid, one of them is, you know, we're all about people. People are our focus. And so if I feel like this person doesn't care genuinely about other people, then they're not going to fit they're not going to fit with our culture, no matter how good they are at their job. Another one of our values is take 100% responsibility. So if during the whole interview, this person has not acknowledged any form of weakness, then this person is probably not going to be fit for our company either, because they're just they're not owning up to their weakness, or they're not owning up to failures or mistakes in the past. It's absolutely impossible that you show up to an interview and not have any failures in your life. And so, or weaknesses or, you know, showing up knowing everything is just impossible. And so, so they're not going to fit. And then fire is just your ability to learn. So, and I don't really care what you learned, as long as you are a chronic learner. So I ask questions like, what have you learned in the past 6 months? What are you learning right now? What have you learned before that? And I'm just trying to determine if there's a pattern of growth, a pattern of learning. I've had some amazing people come in and tell me that they're learning a new language, or that they're learning how to, you know, code, you know, and they're marketers, or they're learning how to, I don't know, do construction, they're learning how to do woodworking. Like, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as you're always learning something and you're curious. What that tells me then is that no matter what problem that life throws at you, or the business throws at you, or I throw at you, that I have the confidence that you have the fire to learn it and to solve it. And so that's been really beneficial for me. And that's a trait that I look in people that join the team. So fit, fire, then fundamentals. If they're fit, if there's fire, if there's growth, if they have the right mindset, Then fundamentals become less important. So how much, and fundamentals I break into a couple of categories: the digital marketing, their conversion rate optimization, their marketing automation, marketing operations, and in some cases, sales development. So those four or five buckets. And I kind of go in loosely and teach one, see how much do you know, how much do you not know, right? So how much do you know about digital marketing? Have you run digital ads before? Have you done display advertising before? Do you understand how to build a lookalike audience? Do you know what suppression lists are? And then we go into conversion rate optimization. Do you know what tools are you using for landing pages? How are you capturing your leads on the site? And then we go into marketing operations. How is your lead moving from the website to the CRM? Do you understand logic? Do you understand how to pull reports? Do you understand how taxonomy works, or should be built? Marketing automation is kind of tied to marketing operations, but it's mostly around segmentation and the automation tool. So do you know how to, build segments so that you have, effective newsletters going out to the right people at the right time? And then the last one is SDR work. So sales development, like how familiar are you with the role, with what their job is, with how to link marketing and the sales development role and the sales role. And so not everybody knows all of those things, and that's okay. Because if they've got the fire, they'll figure out whatever gaps they have.
Yeah. So how many times will you be very intimidating to be interviewed by?
So it's important to know that I don't expect people to come knowing everything. Those are just if you come into the interview and if you've done all five of those, you're not interviewing for this role. You're interviewing for my job, right? And so, which is also okay. If you're better than me, then take my job. They should get rid of me and put someone better. But I'm not looking for people to know everything. I'm looking for people to come in and say, I don't know. But look, I didn't know woodworking 3 months ago either, and I built a cabinet. Great, cool. And you've got, the minimum level of chops necessary to be a good marketer, then that's okay.
Yeah, and I appreciate hearing that, because I think right now everyone expects you to have every skill set there is, but it's impossible, because the programs are different at every company. The tech is always changing, and as long as you're curious and you want to learn and you know the basics, you can learn it pretty easily. Every email program that I've used, yes, there are differences, but the majority are the same, so I'm not ever worried that I'm not going to be able to know how to use it.
And it's so easy to learn. And so I prefer someone who comes in who's not a specialist in marketing automation and says, I'm actually a musician and I'm a hell of a guitar player. I'm pretty decent at marketing automation. I almost prefer that, because when you come in, you're probably going to think of more creative things to do. Everybody can do can develop an email and blast it out. But not everybody can be creative, and not everybody can think about a program in its totality. And so you want creative people, people who learn so you can do exciting things and new things. That's the kind of person you want to hire on your team. That's the kind of person you want to be. Those are the kind of people who are going to be super valuable in the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years, because there's going to be few like them. So, yeah.
Yep.
I'm going on.
Well, you do say that you like to keep on top and always learning. I'm just wondering, is there any newsletters or podcasts that you would recommend to people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've got a whole bunch. I'm a big reader, so I've got a couple books on the go right now. And I'll drop one right now because it just came out. I haven't started it, but this man is absolutely genius. And that's Sell the Way You Buy by David Premer. It's a sales book, and it's... We've had Michael Galliano, who's our head of sales at Hashtag Paid. Him and Deb, who leads our enterprise sales team, they brought David in to do some training with our SDRs and AEs. And he's such a smart, intelligent man. And he runs a company called Cerebral Selling. And it is exactly what the company's name is. It's selling with your brain. And so he relies on a lot of good psychological principles in order to be effective at your job. And so he's phenomenal. And so I'm really, really looking forward to that book. In terms of, you asked for podcasts as well. Was that it?
Yep. Podcasts and newsletters.
Newsletters. Yeah. Newsletters. I subscribe. So we target marketers in e-commerce. And so a lot of the newsletters I'm subscribed to right now, I try to focus on those. And so the number one that I have to say, it's probably the most beneficial. And if you're in e-commerce, if you serve e-commerce people, it's the number one. newsletter you should be subscribed to. It's 2 p.m. And so I'm an executive member, and anyone can be an executive member. It doesn't mean anything. It just, you pay, I think it's like, it comes up to like $10 or $11 a month, but the content is just absolutely phenomenal. It is about e-commerce and direct consumer brands, but it also covers marketing as a whole, and trends as a whole. So absolutely phenomenal. Lean Lux is another great one. It covers kind of luxury brands and the movements in e-commerce. So also a great one. Retail Dive, Trendslates, Loose Threads, The Hustle is really good. So those are a couple there.
You go for a lot.
Yeah, and the podcast is there's a couple good ones.
I'm curious about, because I actively try to seek out good marketing ones. And I've struggled, to be honest. I think eMarketer is probably my favorite at the moment.
So eMarketer is that's it. What I love about eMarketer is that they're short and packed with learning every single episode. So I don't like podcasts that drag on too much. So that's a good one. The Marketing Book Podcast is phenomenal, because you read all these wonderful marketing books and sales books, and then you have the author on with the host discussing the book. So it's phenomenal. So you get a look at the content from a different perspective. So that for me is really exciting. I love The Pitch, because you get to see founders pitch to VCs, and you get to see where they flop and what VCs like and what they don't like. So that's a pretty cool one there. Mm. Wall Street Journal is always a good one if you just want to catch up quickly. And then there's 10 over 3, Canada Covered. I believe it's by, I forget who it's by, but it's 10/3. That's another good one for just to stay in the loop with what's going on in Canada.
Just writing these down.
Yeah. and a couple that I leaned on when I was doing digital marketing was Perpetual Traffic and Marketing School. Perpetual Traffic they're a bit longer episodes, 30, 40 minutes, but just the content that they serve you is, I think they should charge for their podcast. Like they are covering changes in the Facebook algorithm. They are covering changes in Facebook approaches and digital marketing approaches. It's absolutely incredible. If you're a digital marketer, if you're in growth or in demand gen, like that is a podcast you need to be listening to every single day.
Yeah, that's a good one. Thank you.
Yeah.
So while I've got on you here, I did want to pick your brain about influencer marketing. Makes sense, wouldn't it? I guess if we could start, what does actually #paid do?
Yeah. So. #paid we're an influencer marketing platform. And what we do is we connect people with influence online to brands who, you know, have objectives, a lot of them being community building, a lot of them being brand awareness. And in the D2C community and in the e-commerce community, a lot of it is acquisition. And so we partner with those people. We have this incredible creator network. We work with some really great brands. We bring them together and they create some phenomenal content.
And for someone that's never dealt with influencer marketing before, like what kind of budget would you say to start with if you're looking to get into it?
We get that question all the time. So it depends on, you know, is this a B2B brand? Is this a B2C brand? And I think it would depend on your objectives. So I don't have an answer. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question, but, I'd say this, creators, they make a living off of this. The good ones, the ones who are worth paying, they make a living off of this. Their content is engaging, it's valuable. And so you're going to need a minimum amount of money to engage someone, right? So I think the average cost for a creator Instagram post story is like around $600. So that gives you an indication you'll need around about $600 to get a story out. Now, whether a story is enough to get you to your objectives or not, I don't know, but that's around the cost.
And you mentioned B2B brands in there. Like, do you have any examples of how B2B brands do use influencers?
Absolutely. Yeah. You see it very often. You see it very often, especially in the e-commerce community. I mean, we do it, you see it a lot with marketers. You see brands bringing on people. We call them thought leaders, I think, in B2B. Like that's what they've been called. But essentially, they're influencers. They influence people. The nuance with B2B influencer marketing versus B2C is that you can't pay them, As soon as you pay a thought leader, as soon as you pay a B2B influencer to promote you, the irony there is they've lost all of their credibility. Right now, they're going to go, like, let's say they're a consultant or something. They can't go to their client and promote your brand if you're getting paid, because it's going to reek of, you know, it's going to reek of fraud. Like, you can't do that. And so with B2B, you have to do it differently. So, for example, it might be, hey, I'd love to partner with you. Would you come on a webinar with us? Right. And so now your brand is being attributed to their brand. And all of a sudden, you just got a whole bunch of credibility because of them. And so that's how you do it in B2B. You just get really, really influential people in your space, and you have them on, you know, a blog, or you have them on a white paper, or you have them on a webinar, you have them on a podcast, you have them come speak at an event. And you pay them differently, right? The payment can't be, you can't pay them upfront. You can't be like, hey, you come do this and we'll pay you X amount. It looks fishy. But what you can do is, like, you come speak at our conference and we'll pay you. And so you're kind of paying them to speak at the conference, but now there's a relationship, so they're going to speak well of you, and that is more legitimate. So you have to approach it a little bit differently. In B2C, it's very common to pay creators.
I did feel like last year, the I guess the vibe towards influencers had kind of soured a little bit. Did you find that was the case, or was that just kind of people coming a bit, you know, the kind of category coming into maturity, and that's kind of part of the growing pain, is people looking into the statistics of it rather than just jumping into it willy-nilly, I guess. It's not really a question there, just more of a statement. I wanted to see if you had any thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I think I logged into my LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago, and at the top of my feed, it was a very aggressive post just trashing influencer marketing. And as I got into the comments, what I picked up on was that people were equating influencer marketing with celebrity endorsements. And I think, and they were equating it with a lot of what we see maybe happen at, you know, in events like Fyre Festival, for example, right? And so then that leaves a bad taste in people's mouths. They think of influencers as people engaged in those activities, which is not cool. And so I totally understand the negativity around influencer marketing, which is why at Hashtag Pay, we tease out influencers and creators. And so there are good influencers and there are bad influencers. And we call good influencers, we call them creators. These are people who are, they have a passion for their craft. They engage in high quality work. They do the hard work of building an audience the right way, so they're not buying followers, they're not buying engagements, they're not buying likes. So we call those creators, and then we keep on calling bad influencers, we just keep calling them influencers, because there's already a hate for the term, there's already hate for influencers, so we don't even touch that. So you're absolutely right, there is a disdain, I think, for influencer marketing, largely because of influencers, not so much the channel. I think it's the influencers that people don't like, and so for that reason we teased out creators and influencers. And once it's funny, it's semantics and it's just a subtle nuance, but when you explain it to people, they're like, funny, you just articulated what I hate about influencer marketing, why I've never tried it. And it's because of the people, it's the people that they don't like, or the people they've heard of, the influencers. That's why they don't like influencer marketing. So once we tease it out, they're more open, and they're more open to discussing it and making it a line item on their budget.
Yeah, and as I said, I just think it's part of the category getting a bit more maturity, and people actually are like, all right, I'm not just going to jump and throw money at this. I'm actually going to look at the statistics. And I think that's weeding out some of those bad players who, you know, have fake accounts and fake followers. So I think it's just a symptom of it being successful, to be honest.
It is. And there's a lack of, in this channel in the past couple of years, there's just been a lack of, I think, transparency with regards to the actual metrics. So how you determine whether it's been successful. It's never really been part of a mixed model in the enterprise world. People haven't really attributed revenue to it. So I think some of the more, there's some brands you have, you know, brands like Revolve or Glossier, they've done a really good job at it. Brands like Manscaped, they have a pretty strong affiliate program. And so, there are some brands who've been able to attribute sales to it, but largely the metrics have been pretty obscure. And so that's left us a bad taste in people's mouths. But as platforms like Hashtag Pay come to the market and we make it more transparent and we show you the data and we show you what it's doing and what it's not doing, people are more open to doing influencer marketing, for sure.
And speaking of the data, like if you're running an influencer campaign, what kind of results should you expect? Is it good for converting sales, getting leads, followers, brand awareness, anything of those?
Yeah, it's good. So the first thing that we do with our customers is we ask them what they're looking to do. For some people, it is acquisition. So they're looking to sell product, right? We work with a brand called Attitude, and they're looking to sell their bed linens, right? We work with another brand called Lucy, and it's like they're looking to sell their product. And Native Deodorant, they're trying to sell their deodorant. And so those brands are looking to sell their product. There's other brands who are looking to do a subscription. Or sign people up for their subscription, for their newsletter, so that they can build an audience. So that's what they're using influencer marketing for. Other people use influencer marketing to generate reviews on whatever review site they use. So it depends on the goal. And from there, then you tweak the program and you tweak who you work with. So if you're doing a bottom funnel campaign, you might only work with two or three creators and you might do whitelisting for the rest of it because you can, and for people listening, if you don't know what creator whitelisting is, it's just when you run ads through their account versus your brand account. And so that converts about three times better. And what that does is you don't have to work with 50 influencers or creators to get to a certain sales number. You can work with two or three and then just run paid social ads through their account. We call it creator whitelisting. And doing that allows you to optimize to the conversion. So it allows you to use the Facebook algorithm and the creator content at the same time. So it's pretty powerful in that sense. If you're trying to build community, if you're trying to shift perception, if you want to position your product, then you're probably relying more on the organic influencer marketing campaigns. And that's just the organic posts that the creator posts on their channel or on their feed. Then you're probably going to work with maybe five or six creators to do that. And you might work with, if it's more of an awareness thing, if you're trying to, optimize for reach or impressions, then you might work with maybe the bigger, people with higher follower counts. If you're looking, if you're a smaller brand and you're looking to, you have one product and it's a very specific use, then you might work with smaller creators because they have a very targeted and niche audience. And the thinking there is the more followers you have, the more diverse your audience, and the more diverse your audience, the harder it is to actually, be personalized, right? Just because if you think of like Lily Singh, who's a, digital first celebrity creator, you can be a mother, you can be a student, you can be male or female, you can live in Idaho or in New York City, you're going to be watching her for entertainment. And so if you're a brand, those two people, students, mothers, maybe totally different, right? And so Lily Singh may not be the influencer for you. She may not be the person, but if you partner with someone who maybe has 25,000, she's maybe a mommy blogger, and she has about 25,000 followers on her Instagram account, and you sell baby products, that is gonna be a really, really good partnership for you. And it's probably gonna drive your metrics better. Smaller creators tend to allow you to be more personalized. The higher the follower count, the more diverse, the less personalized you can be. And so we see brands, wow, that was a long answer. We see brands using influencer marketing up and down the funnel. And depending on your goal, you are going to either do organic campaigns or create a whitelisting. And then again, depending on your goal, you're going to work with, high follower counts or small follower counts.
Mm-hmm. And do you think in the current situation we find ourselves in that there's an opportunity that marketers should maybe look to influencers who can create typically from their computer as a one-person show compared to needing an advertising agency who can't really grab everyone at the moment to get them in a studio, for instance?
Totally. Like, think of it. Think of all the production studios that are down, all the agencies that are down. The same equipment they use, for the most part, the same equipment that they use is the exact equipment that creators own. Like, if I show you, we have a car manufacturer who works with us, and they paid $400,000 for one of their television creatives, and we have a video that our creator created, and that one cost, I think it was $4,000. So it was $4,000, $400,000. And I promise you, I promise you that if you were to look at both videos, you wouldn't know which one was which, because they own the same gear for the most part. And so they can produce the same level of quality. The benefit that the creator has, there's two big benefits. One specific to COVID-19, the situation around COVID-19, which is they can still create content, you know, inside their home. They can still engage audiences, which is a huge benefit. They're not reliant on multiple people. For the most part, they're one people shows, one woman shows, one man shows. And so good on them. I think the other advantage that they have is that they're able to build engaging content with a proven track record, right? Remember, these people have an audience. And for the most part, they built it from scratch. And so in order to build influence online, they've had to create engaging content over and over and over and over again. And in order to maintain your influence, you have to be consistent with the content that you put out. It has to be consistently good. And so when you engage a creator, not only are they capable of doing it right now, they're able of doing it and engage people. They prove it every single day with their interactions. Every time their follower count increases, they're proving that their content is good and engaging. And so as a brand, even if you're not using them for distribution, right, as a marketing channel to get your message to a consumer, even if you're just using them for the creative, for the content, for them, so that you can go and repurpose and reuse it, you're still benefiting, and it's loads cheaper.
Yeah, it's like I was watching that. I don't know if you watched the SNL that just came out, where they're all trying to do it from home, and I'm just like, oh, they should just need some influencers who have already figured this out, because watching these cars try to like make a production that's like on par with Saturday Night Live is pretty cringeworthy at some points. Just before you go, I got a couple of questions about the current situation, and just going to keep this kind of open-ended, just because you are someone who kind of keeps his finger on the pulse. Do you have any predictions or trends that you think will come out of the marketing world during this pandemic and afterwards?
I think I think a lot of people were getting away with pretty shoddy marketing practices. And what I think this situation forced them to do was to think a little bit more about the consumer. I think marketing should have always been at the forefront of empathy in business communication. And the reality is it hasn't, unfortunately. And so what I think COVID-19 is forcing, one of the trends we'll see for a little while until it reverts back, because I think it will, it's just human tendency, you know, to revert back to whatever is easiest. But I think at least for the next good chunk of time, we're going to start seeing better marketing, more thoughtful marketing, more empathetic marketing. So, I think that's one of them. That's one trend. And then the other one is just really obvious. I think you saw this with, I think, SARS back in 2003 or 2004, like when SARS hit China. I think at the time, China was behind the US in terms of like e-commerce sales. You can read in the book Alibaba by, I think it's Duncan Clark, I think was his name. It's the story of Jack Ma and Alibaba, and you can read it in there. But I think in 2003, when SARS hit, the e-commerce or online sales, just they skyrocketed in China to where they do a lot more business than we do here in North America, like way more business. And so I mean, this is obvious. I think a million people have said it already, but you're just going to see, I think, a bigger shift towards maybe e-commerce. And not maybe, you're going to see it. Like, my parents are, you know, they're close to 60, and, you know, they might have not made a certain online purchase 2 months ago, and now they're making it, right? And so they're just, when you're forced into, you know, moving into the online world or into purchasing things online, and you do it, it becomes less scary. And so you're just probably going to see more people who wouldn't have purchased online before purchase now. And so as a result, e-commerce sales and online sales will go up, which is awesome. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's creating a comfort level that they haven't quite had before. And I think that's even the same for marketing. I think we're going to see people shift their advertising dollars to digital ones because they'll have to learn it now.
And I'm hoping people will try influencer marketing now, right? A lot of those, you know, a lot of those dollars that were being used, you know, in traditional channels, which are pretty cool. I love them. Don't get me wrong. I can appreciate a good billboard. There's a couple great ones off the Gardner. But I'm hoping that they shift to influencer marketing. That'd be pretty exciting for them.
So on that note, is if people do want to reach out about influencer marketing, should they reach out to you or go to the website?
Yeah, they can go. It's hashtagpaid.com. My email is, my work email is r, my last name, which is really long, so I won't like list it here. Maybe you can put it in the show notes. It's rlastname@hashtagpaid.com. You can connect with me on Twitter. I'm Roger Figs, Roger Figs. Same handle on Instagram. You can catch me on LinkedIn. It's just my first name, last name. So yeah, connect with me anywhere. I think I'm everywhere.
And if people want to listen to your podcast?
If you want to listen to the podcast, I highly encourage you to do so, even if you're not in e-commerce, because we cover people who've made their dreams, who've turned their dreams into reality. We talk about someone who started building toothpaste from her living room with, I think it was $6,000. We talk to founders who started from nothing, just with a dream. And so it's a D2C growth show. We're everywhere where you get your podcast. But it's even if you're not in e-commerce, I think it's just a good encouragement and a good reminder that you know, if you have an idea, if you have a dream, and if you learn, and if you can work hard at it, you might be able to turn it into reality.
Yeah. And do it for love. That's what we learned on this podcast. That might be the title.
Do it for love.
Well, thanks for coming on the podcast. It's been a really interesting chat, and definitely learned a lot myself here. I got a page of notes here next to me.
Cool. Good stuff. Thanks so much, Michael.